Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two segments today. In moments, Rebecca Gordon will explain why so many Nicaraguans are in the streets protesting a once admirable government. And at the bottom of the hour, Alex Gurevich will talk about coercion on the job and the importance of strikes. Before that, a few words, some logistical, some polemical. First, a technical note. I'm on a working vacation in Montreal for a couple of weeks, and the infrastructure here is less than ideal for radio production. An echoey room, which can only be partly compensated for with an audio filter and a wobbly internet connection, which produce some funky Skype calls. My apologies. And then the political commentary. Good God, the Russia obsession. It seems that Democrats are now incapable of talking about anything but Russian interference in our sacred elections. The Trump administration is eviscerating environmental regulations, appointing horrific judges, prosecuting a grotesque war on refugees and immigrants, and we're hearing about little other than Putin's alleged hold over Trump, often expressed in grossly homophobic terms. In doing so, they're accepting, and critically, the version of events proffered by cops, prosecutors, and the CIA, organizations made up of professional liars who've been enemies of democracy and free expression at home and abroad for decades. We're seeing Dem pundits even accusing Bernie Sanders and other insurgents within their party of being Russian agents, witting or unwitting. Their indictments of Trump for treason make them sound like demented right-wingers at the height of the Cold War. This obsession does relieve mainstream Democrats of concocting an attractive agenda that might win an election or two, but to do that, they'd have to tack left, and Goldman Sachs wouldn't like that. This Russia obsession is a win-win for the establishment, though. Subdue Trump and the domestic left insurgency all at once. I understand why those within a half a standard deviation of the center would embrace it, but why anyone further left would play along with it is beyond me. Please stop. Okay, Nicaragua. Over the last few months, Nicaraguans have been in the streets protesting the government led by Daniel Ortega, and that government has been responding brutally. For anyone who remembers the 1980s but hasn't been following events in that country since, this is shocking and confusing. The Sandinistas deposed a nasty U.S.-supported dictator, Anastasio Somoza, in 1979, and then governed in a mostly admirable way throughout the 1980s, despite an evil war against them sponsored by the Reagan administration. How did Nicaragua come to this sorry pass? Here's Rebecca Gordon, a philosopher and ethicist who teaches at the University of San Francisco, with some answers. An article of hers on Nicaraguan events appeared in Tom Dispatch and was reprinted by NACLA. Rebecca Gordon. A lot of people are confused by what's going on in Nicaragua. A lot of people on the American left idealize the Sandinista regime from the 1980s and Daniel Ortega, its leader in the 80s and 90s. And now we see a whole wave of popular protests against the Ortega government. What's this all about?
Wow. Well, when you say a lot of people are confused, I think it's fair to say that that's true around the world and that there's a lot of disagreement even within Nicaragua itself. I have friends, for example, whose families are split on whether they continue to support Daniel Ortega or whether they think that the uprising is the right thing to do and an appropriate response. So what's going on? First of all, I want to correct one thing, which is that I don't think it's quite accurate to say that Daniel Ortega was the leader of the Sandinistas in the 1980s. He was certainly their presidential candidate in two elections and a very key leader. But there were other people within the Sandinistas who were also very important and who had a role in forming policy and so forth. So just to make it clear that part of what's gone on is a shift in the role of Daniel Ortega within what is still called the Sandinista Party. So, what's going on? In April of this year, students in the university began going out into the streets to protest, and the first thing that they were concerned about was the fact that there was a wildfire burning in a very important biodiverse forest that was known as Indio Maíz. And apparently they were concerned that the Ortega government was doing nothing to stop this. And there were a lot of theories going around that maybe actually people wanted that land cleared by fire in order to be able to bring in cattle farming. There was a lot of question about why this was being allowed to happen, or maybe it was incompetence, or to use one of my favorite terms that I got from some people in El Salvador, maybe it was strategic incompetence. In any case, people were angry about it, and they went out into the streets. The issue became moot because the wind changed and the fires basically died out. But within a week or two, another issue arose, which was that in order to fit the requirements for an austerity budget that were being imposed by the International Monetary Fund, the Ortega government decided that they were going to make changes to the funding of the Social Security system. So they were simultaneously going to raise taxes, which annoyed especially the private industry sector, including the organization that's similar to our National Chamber of Commerce, which is called COSEP. So those people were angry on one side, but it also angered people on the other side, ordinary people who depend on those pensions, because simultaneously with raising the taxes, they lowered the benefits that were being paid out. And this at a time when there's actually substantial inflation in Nicaragua. So people were mad about that. I don't think from this distance that things would have gone as far as they have if the Ortega government had not responded the way they did, which was with deadly repression, with a combination of riot police and these paramilitary thugs, essentially, who are called turbas, like these divine gangs, who began attacking the demonstrations and killing people. A friend of mine, a woman named Ana Quiroz, was beaten up very badly. She's the head of an organization called CISAS, which has been doing popular health education in Nicaragua since 1983. She was very much a supporter of the Nicaraguan Revolution and of the whole process of change in the 1980s. And here she was out on the streets and very badly beaten for her trouble. As you know, by now, over 300 people have actually been killed. The thing has escalated. Then what happened is that people all over the country began putting up barricades, which is a common response to unrest in much of Latin America, but especially in Nicaragua. And it has a history that goes back to the Sandinista insurrection, when people used to go to the streets and pull up, they call them adoquines, the paving cement blocks that actually came out of the then dictator's own factory, Somoza's factory, and used them to build barricades. So now there are barricades all over Nicaragua, which the government is using tremendous and deadly force to pull down, most recently over the weekend in the town of Masaya. And what's going on with the barricades is complicated, too, because in many cases they've been erected by people in neighborhoods to keep the police out because they're afraid of the police. And there are stories of the police, for example, in Masaya going past the barricades and actually going into people's homes and pulling them out and shooting them in the street because they were people who were on a list of some sort or another. But in other places, there are people who've decided that setting up a barricade is a great way to make a fast buck. And so there are a lot of people, or at least some people in some places, who have set up barricades and are primarily using them to extort money in order to allow anybody, you know, vehicles to get in and out of towns in order to do their business. So that's also a complication.
Why is the government responding so brutally?
You know, that is a question I keep asking myself over and over again because it doesn't make sense to me. I honestly think, from a tactical point of view, that if they had allowed the demonstrations to go on even for a couple of weeks, that probably they would have died out. But who knows what would have happened? I think what they were afraid of is what has happened, which is that they would go from being a response to a particular or one or two particular policy issues to being a generalized demand for the end of the government, and that's what's happened now.
Now, the Daniel Ortega of today is rather different from the Daniel Ortega of 20, 25 years ago. Tell us how he's evolved over that period.
Okay, so really it's more like 40 years ago, if you can believe it. It was 34 years ago in 1984 that I lived for 6 months in Nicaragua at, you know, right in the middle of the hottest parts of the Contra War, and my job was to report on Contra violence, but also at the time when the, what they called the proceso or the revolutionary process was really at its height. So the Sandinista Party, which came into power in 1979 when the dictator Somoza was deposed, that party was composed of three separate tendencies. But the party itself was a coalition. It came into power in a coalition with other sectors of the society, which gradually did kind of fall away. So by 1984, when the first elections were held, the Sandinista Party was the major governing entity in the country. And they stepped in, I swear, the insurrection ended July 19th. It's almost like they hit the ground on July 20th with plans for improving the well-being of what was then the poorest country in the Northern Hemisphere, certainly the poorest country in Central America. And so they started with healthcare. They, by 1981, had wiped out polio and got an award from the World Health Organization for this. They brought healthcare to people who had never had it. They began providing all kinds of services that hadn't been there before, including telephone services and so forth, to poor people, especially in the rural areas. They provided subsidies so that people could have a basic basket of food and, before the insurrection, really and malnutrition was endemic in the country. They really did a tremendous amount to end malnutrition. They set up the economy, which was a combination of private enterprise, state-run businesses, and cooperatives. That was a compromise within the party, but it also gave them a very strong, maybe not so much a strong economy, but certainly a strong face to the world about what they were doing. They also, by the way, continue paying all of the loans that they had received from the United States, or that Nicaragua had received from the United States during the time when Somoza was in power. So there was a sense in which they were really doing their best to get along with the world. And interestingly and very importantly, they put in place what was called the Literacy Crusade. And this was modeled on a similar campaign in Cuba after their revolution. And what they did was they asked young people, and especially high school students from the bigger cities, from the middle class, to go out and live for 5 or 6 months with a campesino or peasant family in the countryside. And while living with that family in their little two-room dirt floor houses, they learned from that family where their own food came from and what subsistence farming was like and what that life was like. And in return, they taught those families to read. And they cut illiteracy from something like 45% of the country down to 10% of the country in the course of a couple of years. Not only that, they brought a whole generation of young people into the struggle for a better Nicaragua, to the extent that today there's an NGO that my partner happens to sit on the board of called El Porvenir that does water access and watershed reclamation. And they, many of their Nicaraguan organizers are actually people who got their start in the world of political engagement as part of this literacy campaign. That was the Sandinistas of the 1980s. As people who are familiar with the history will know, in 1984, they were elected. Daniel Ortega was the candidate for president. Sergio Ramirez was his vice president. They were elected with 67% of the vote. In 1986, a National Constitutional Assembly approved a new constitution for Nicaragua, which had a number of really important points, including regional autonomy for the Atlantic coast and some control over their natural resources, which is where some of the most important and valuable resources of the country actually are, and also rights for various groups of people like LGBT people and also women. And it was a very progressive constitution in the model of a number of progressive constitutions.
I'm speaking with Rebecca Gordon, a philosopher and ethicist who's been following Nicaragua for decades.
It included a 6-year term for the presidency. So in 1990, the elections took place 6 years after 1984, and a coalition of center-right parties called UNO, with a woman named Violeta Chamorro as the presidential candidate, won the election. And then something kind of amazing happened. For the first time that I know of in history, a revolutionary organization that had taken power more or less by violent means, although the truth is that every sector had stopped supporting Somoza by the time that the insurrection succeeded in driving him out of the country. But in any case, a revolutionary organization actually accepted defeat at the ballot box and turned the government over to UNO, which was the name of this coalition. However, there was a period of several months between the elections and the transfer of power. Just as happens in this country, we vote in November and the inauguration takes place in January. So during that time was a period that came to be known as La Piñata. And a piñata, you know, is one of those paper mache toys that's full of toys and candy that you break open. And what happened was that people in the Sandinista Party, people, and the way we explained it to ourselves at the time, those of us who wanted to still believe in the Sandinistas, was that these were people who had sacrificed so much. They had spent years living in the mountains as guerrillas. They had never, you know, because they had devoted their entire adult lives to the revolution, they'd never had a chance to, you know, have any kind of economic life of their own. So this was their opportunity not to starve. Whatever. In any case, what happened during La Piñata is that the government was sacked, and it was sacked for everything from vehicles to houses to state enterprises to money. And many people believe that it was at this point and through the piñata that Daniel Ortega himself, as well as some other Sandinista leaders, began to develop their own personal fortunes. It was after this piñata and after, again, inside baseball, but after an assembly of the Sandinista Party itself in which one current was asking for greater democracy within the party, and that current lost and a more autocratic, authoritarian strain won, that quite a few people who were well known to people around the world who had supported the revolution actually left the Sandinista Party. But the party itself remained. And one other thing to say about the 1990 election, the people in Nicaragua were not stupid. And they knew that as long as the Sandinistas were in power, the United States was going to continue to form, to be supporting this ugly, vicious Contra war. And so the only way they were going to stop the war was to get rid of the Sandinistas. And that's what they did. So we come to this period in between 1990 and 2006 when Daniel Ortega again was elected to the presidency. And in those many years in between, he began cozying up to a number of, frankly, right-wing elements. So the president after Chamorro in 1996 was a man named Alemán, Arnaldo Alemán. And he was a real right-winger from the hard right, from the old Somocista party. He was also really corrupt. The Sandinistas of the day, which were not now the old Sandinistas, made what was called El Pacto, or the pact, the agreement between Alemán's party and the Sandinistas. And when Daniel Ortega was reelected as president in 2006, he came to the aid of Alemán, who in the meantime had been taken out of office and convicted of terrible corruption, and he had stolen hundreds of millions of dollars, was put under house arrest in Managua. When Daniel came into power, he said, "Ah, well, Mr. Alemán, Managua, the capital city, is your house." And then later on, he said, "Well, actually, all of Nicaragua is your house." So essentially, he freed Alemán. And he and his wife, Rosario Murillo, had a conversion to a particular charismatic form of Roman Catholicism, with the result that, among other things, they became fanatically anti-abortion. And Nicaragua has one of the harshest anti-abortion laws in the world as a result today. So in the time since 2006, when Daniel was reelected, he has brought in changes to the Constitution that allow him to essentially be elected over and over and over again. There had been term limits, a two-term limit to the presidency in the past. But now with the new Constitution, he can run as often as he likes. In 2016, he got rid of the guy who had been his vice president and ran with Rosario Murillo, his wife, as his vice president. And he continues to run what many people believe is a very corrupt, self-serving, and autocratic government. I will say, I was there in October, and I hadn't been there for about 8 or 9 years, and I was truly surprised, because I was mostly out in the countryside, by the level of development that has taken place. It's not as though people who live in tiny houses now have running water way out in the countryside, but what they do all have is cell phones. Many of them have generators and satellite dishes. So people whose grandparents never went more than 50 miles from where they were born and whose knowledge of the outside world only came through maybe the newspaper that might have come once a week to their town, if they were even living in a town, those grandchildren today are now connected to the entire world through their cell phones, which have completely leapfrogged landline technology, and through internet access through satellites. And it's a major, major change in who the Nicaraguan people are, in a way. In addition, there's been road building. Because an election was coming up, there's also been a lot of work on big public construction. And all over, you see these billboards, these bright pink billboards with pictures of Rosario and Daniel. And it says, "Cristianismo y socialismo," Christianity and socialism. And then it goes on and is covered with hearts and flowers. And these are your rulers who want the best for you.
Now, is there anything like a political opposition, a coherent political opposition that's been developing at all?
See, this is the problem. And this is what really, really worries me. There are there's a thing called the Revolutionary Sandinista Movement. And it started by people like Sergio Ramirez, who was vice president back in the 80s under Daniel Ortega, Dora Maria Tellez, who's known to many people. She was the minister of health under the early Sandinista governments, and a number of other people that people who've been following Nicaragua would recognize. But it's a tiny party, and it has no support base. It has no real base. It doesn't win anything at the polls. There is no coherent, organized force that would be ready to step in if the Ortega government were to collapse the way the Somoza government did in 1979. The people who have been coming out onto the streets in their hundreds of thousands, especially the university students, they call themselves the autoconvocados, which means the self-convened. In other words, nobody is running them, they are running themselves, which is lovely on the one hand. It means that they're not beholden to some puppet master, say, in the United States. But at the same time, they do not represent an organized force with a program, the way the Sandinistas were an organized force with a program ready to hit the ground when Somoza was removed. And this really, really worries me. It would be a desperate shame to see Nicaragua turn into the kind of, you know, what's called a failed state, which would, of course, immediately open the way for U.S. intervention, because we can't have a failed state in our backyard. And the history of U.S. intervention in Nicaragua is long and bloody. But at the same time, this repression, this outright murder, not only through police and military, but through these paramilitary thugs, can't continue. It's just too awful. So it's a very bad situation. The only thing that I'm really sure of is it's a situation that would be made even worse if the U.S. were to decide to insert itself in some way.
That was Rebecca Gordon, a philosopher and ethicist who teaches at the University of San Francisco. Her article on the Nicaraguan troubles appeared in Tom Dispatch and was reprinted by NACLA. You're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henmer. The program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the second movement is Schubert's Piano Trio No. 1, performed by the Beaux-Arts Trio. Next, strikes. My friend and frequent guest Jane McAlevey likes to quote one of her mentors, Jerry Brown, the former head of 1199 New England, a healthcare workers' union, as saying the strike is like a muscle. If not exercised, it atrophies. And with it, the power of the working class. Strikes have largely disappeared in the U.S. There were teachers' strikes several months ago, but even if that level of activity were to continue for the rest of the year, the annual measures of work stoppages would barely rise to the levels of the 1990s and 2000s. What does this mean? And what is it about the workplace that makes strikes so important? Here's Alex Gurevich, an assistant professor of political science at Brown, to explain. He explores all this in a recent article on the Jacobin Magazine website. Alex Gurevich. We've seen a brief uptick in the number of strikes in the U.S., particularly the teachers, but that, you know, there's been a long downtrend in strike activity in the U.S. for the last couple of decades. What does this mean for the working class?
Well, as I think you and I agree, there is no substitute for mass militant collective action by the working class. All the evidence suggests that all of these other strategies of trying to work with management, finding corporate strategies, hoping pension funds will take a more active role in management, any of the kind of alternatives to the political and legislative strategies by the union spending a whole bunch of dollars trying to elect candidates who screw them when they get elected. None of that stuff works. And the story of the last 30, 40 years, since about 1974, when there was the precipitous decline in strike activity, or when that decline began, we've just seen the power and income and wealth of the working class just decline.
That date you just cited, 1974, was before Reagan fired Patco, which is often taken as a watershed. What happened in the mid-70s that really got things going badly for the working class?
It's a good question. I mean, that's the beginning of the counter-revolution by capital against the kind of growing militancy of the 60s. The early 70s is the point at which it looked like, the late 60s is the point at which it looked like the mass mobilization around racial equality would connect up with the growing massive working class resistance to Vietnam and declining living standards and produce a really massive working class movement.
there's that cliche that the 60s hit the working class in the 70s.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you see it politically. I mean, you know, why is it that suddenly the House was starting to be ready to withhold funding for Vietnam? Because all these working class constituencies throughout the country were demanding that their representatives just stop supporting Vietnam and that they would stop voting for them, because it was the working class, you know, was getting slaughtered in Vietnam, as well as some members of the middle class. Even strikes were becoming more militant, much more wildcats. You saw large numbers of workers who were willing to strike against advice or support of labor leadership, and for demands that weren't just higher wage demands, but against the war. I think a full story of that still really hasn't been told yet, but it's kind of peaks in 72, 73, and capital changes, realizes it's going to change strategies. There's other geopolitical things happening, the collapse of Bretton Woods, the kind of growing profit squeeze because Western Europe has now reindustrialized, so there's more intense capitalist competition globally. And American capitalists increasingly start to rethink the post-war contract and start putting a tighter squeeze on workers. And they go in particular after the labor practices and legal practices that gave workers sort of more leeway in organizing and striking. And so what matters about PATCO and the replacement of strikers is actually, I mean, the backstory is this. In 1939, there was a Supreme Court ruling called McKay Radio, in which there was this weird little piece of legal dicta in which they said, okay, workers have a right to strike. You can't fire them for organizing and wanting to organize a union or threatening to strike. However, employers can permanently replace them. But for about 40 years, employers didn't actually do that. And they didn't do that because workers were well organized enough and there was a broader political culture that required most businesses to instead kind of negotiate with unions and union leadership in exchange for getting unions and union leaders to basically become administrators of the labor contract. They would limit the militancy of membership in exchange for some negotiating act, some place at the bargaining table, some contracts with employers, and some limitations on what employers are willing to do. And so one of the things they didn't do, tend to do, was permanently replace workers when they went on strike. But in the 70s, in the midst of this beginning of the revanchist moment and the lead up to the kind of change in corporate governance and financial structure that you talk about in Wall Street, actually, employers start just becoming much more openly hostile to workers. They no longer think there's any need to kind of manage labor relations. And so they just start stopping negotiating with union leaders and openly violating labor law, and then replacing workers when they go on strike. And they start doing this in the mid-70s and the late-70s. There's kind of like an amazing strike in Iowa in 1980, actually, by these white packing workers. And they go on strike, and they're getting permanently replaced. And the only person who shows up is Angela Davis, who's on the communist ticket. And there's this like amazing moment where the only person putting strikers openly is neither Republican nor Democrat, but Angela Davis, this like black communist who's running on the communist ticket. So all these like Iowa workers are kind of like thinking about communism again because they're all bewildered. They're like, what happened to these relations we thought we had? And then what PATCO does is say it's open season. Everyone can do this because at the very top, the state's going to take the side of capitalists. And then that's it. Like in the 80s, then employers just really put the hammer. They start trying to provoke strikes so that they can replace workers. Because if the workers stay out for a year, then they can decertify the union as well and just destroy the union entirely and redo a union out of their scab workers. And then that's just a long, precipitous decline there. But PATCO is more the kind of declaration, open declaration of whose side the state is on. It's not going to try and manage in any way relations between capital and labor. It's just on the side of the capitalists. And it just kind of puts the seal of approval on what they've been doing for about a decade.
Now, in your article, the Jacobin article, which is based on a longer academic article, you review the ways in which employees are seriously subordinated in their relationship with their bosses. This is a real authoritarian relationship. Just remind us of all the dimensions of that inequality.
What I try and do is say, look, the way to think about the right to strike is that it's a right to resist oppression. And by open, I just mean just unjustifiable constraints on people's freedoms. And there's some things that people think about all the time, like fact that the working class is forced into the labor market because it doesn't have any reasonable alternative to finding a job. The thing about the workplace is, you know, if you compare it with the family is now close to, at least legally speaking, an institution based on equality. Like, women, when they get married, are not subject to couverture laws anymore, where, like, the husband owns their property, they don't inherit property, he can force them to work, he can take their wages. They stand as equals, you know, there's no-fault divorce, custody laws, you know, sometimes even favor women. There's been some liberalization of family law. In the workplace, that's just not the case. It is a completely unequal relationship. Employees are formally understood as subordinates. They're required to obey the commands of their employers. This can include control over things as intimate as when they can go to the bathroom. The employer decides almost all disciplinary procedures, can require they engage in mandatory drug testing, can fire them for totally arbitrary reasons, like not being attractive enough. I sort of collect a number of examples like this. They also determine what kinds of work are going to be done, when those kinds of work are going to be changed. When I covered the Verizon strike, one of the objections of these Verizon workers was that anytime they wanted to go to the bathroom or get a drink of water, they had to call and ask permission from their manager. And if their manager didn't formally give them permission, but they went to the bathroom anyway, they'd be sanctioned and could lose like a month of work. So it's a very authoritarian place. People don't often think about this, but it's actually one of the most important forms of oppression that I think workers tend to resist when they go on strike.
But it's so normalized that often people don't think twice about it.
Yeah, people don't think twice about it. I mean, they don't think twice about it. On the other hand, like, lots and lots of people who actually work are very aware of it. And I think some of this is sort of a matter of just who gets to do a lot of the official thinking in our society. Like, the people who get to do a lot of the official thinking in academia and the chattering classes, the commentariat, they come from the upper class. They come from either the educated professions, where there tends on average to be more personal autonomy in the work. They're less directly subject to all kinds of crazy bosses. Or they are just wealthy. And to the degree that they're even ever had to work in workplace in the typical workplace, they did temporarily see it as not a permanent feature of their life, and so it weighs much less heavily on their thinking. The moment I really noticed this was there was this funny moment in one of the presidential debates in 2016 when Clinton raised this incident where Trump had refused to pay somebody who he owed money for work on a hotel, something like that. And I remember Trump interrupted her and said, because he did a bad job. And I remember just thinking, if Clinton had an even ounce of class awareness, that would have been just the best moment to just seize on what was on a popular experience, which is anyone who's in the most people in the working class have worked for bosses who make them do stuff and then underpaid them or didn't pay them at all. It's an extraordinarily common occurrence of the kind of daily experience of oppression. She could have seized that and kind of made much more of not just how he's rich, but the special kind of asshole he is, not in as Trump, but as just the typical rich employer who tries to screw workers.
Of course, she was the daughter of a small businessman, so her consciousness was formed from the other side.
I'm talking about something never would happen, obviously. I mean, she, as you pointed out, her first date with Bill was crossing the picket line. Like, you know, she has none of those political instincts, but I just remember thinking about it. And that was a moment where, because most of the official thinking happens by people who have no real contact and don't really think about these daily experiences for most people, nobody talks about it. But I don't think that means that not that many people are actually thinking about it. They think about it a lot. I think maybe they think about it as a personal experience because in many situations they don't recognize this as like a common shared class experience. For that, I think requires institutions and organizations like the really militant wing of the labor movement and left-wing political organizations that actually have real contact with elements of the working class, which is something we don't have very much of.
I'm speaking with the political scientist, Alex Gurevich. Okay, now let's talk about strikes specifically. You mentioned the Verizon workers. The Verizon workers are highly skilled. If they withdraw their services, the employer has to scramble to replace them. They're not easily replaced. It's a different story for fast food workers. How do fast food workers exert some sort of collective power? Is it even possible?
Yeah. The bottom line is, yes, it is totally possible. And historically, low-skilled workers who are relatively easily replaced in all kinds of basic industries and services in the United States historically actually exercise an extraordinary amount of collective class power. I mean, the U.S. has an incredibly militant mass strike history that you can trace back to around slightly arbitrarily signed a date, 1877, the great strike of 1877, all the way through to 1974. And for decades, you saw these extraordinary strikes by quite poor, much worse off workers than many of even today's not very well off workers in the United States. So they can certainly do it. But the thing about these strikes is that to be effective, they have to be coercive. They have to prevent employers from hiring replacements or prevent scabs from crossing the line or otherwise just make it impossible for work to go on, because that's the point of a strike, is to stop production. And to do that, they have to use tactics like mass pickets, where you have just massive numbers of people that surround the workplace to prevent anything from going in and out, or sit-down strikes, which is a classic tactic for occupying a workplace and preventing work from getting done, or sometimes even kinds of sabotage. But the thing about those tactics is that they're almost always illegal. There's almost no way to do them without running afoul of all kinds of labor law and other areas of law. And what really matters is that you have a kind of militancy and organization among these workers such that they're willing to face the law and also take the risk of losing in order to win a strike. And that's a difficult thing to do. But it is absolutely possible. But one ingredient in building that power is knowing what the good arguments are for supporting that kind of activity. I certainly don't think that the writing I've done is like a substitute for organizing, but it's just meant to think through sort of why do workers have a right to do this? It's going to be massively illegal. It's going to sometimes involve enormous confrontation with the police, but it's a right they have to resist oppression they face as members of the working class in a capitalist society.
The workers you're describing in the last quarter of the 19th century into the early 20th faced extraordinary violence, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, the kind of difficulty with the historical comparison is, on the one hand, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of workers, sometimes millions of workers in the past who faced outright violence, both by private goons and thugs and assassins that were hired by the likes of Ford or U.S. Steel or less well-known major companies, but also by federal troops and the police. You know, people are very interested these days in the militarization of the police, and I've done some research on this, and the origins of the militarization of the police is actually in the late 19th century when they acquired the role of strikebreakers. Originally, the police were there to hire, to arrest basically drunks and prostitutes. The modern police forces, not their predecessors, but modern urban police forces. In fact, the ruling class didn't want to pay taxes to pay for police forces. And it's only when you started getting these large strikes, the ruling class realized their private security forces weren't enough to break these strikes. And so they started paying taxes and privately donating money and arms to create a modern militarized police force that would beat up strikers and break them. And then started bringing in federal troops when those police weren't enough. So in the past, you had extremely militant. Sometimes these were like running battles. I mean, the Battle of Blair Mountain in West Virginia, which actually some of those old things came up during the West Virginia teacher strike, they're kind of recovering that militant spirit. But they were willing to sometimes even fight the cops when necessary. So they're extraordinarily militant, but that requires a militant minority of really radical labor organizers who are really committed to left-wing principles and want to organize workers on that basis. And it's at the moment, that's at least one major element that just doesn't seem to be a part of the labor movement. There are people willing to make the argument, but in terms of being part of the labor movement and trying to win workers to that cause, in a way you'd think it'd be easier. It's a little bit harder to imagine the contemporary state using that kind of open, naked violence against masses of workers as compared to 100 years ago. It's one of the maybe limited signs of progress. But then again, we don't know. Maybe once the modern, you know, the American state starts getting tested seriously by a very militant workers' movement, we could see them break out the guns again.
Other countries didn't see anything like the kind of violence we saw in the U.S. 150 years ago. It's just extraordinary machine gunning of strikers. It's just breathtaking. And, you know, people look now and wonder why the American labor movement is so relatively weak. That history of violence is not an inconsiderable portion of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of three things that explain it. One is there was just extraordinary violence, and that's in part because unlike the other European industrial powers. The U.S. only directly militarized its working class quite late. I mean, France, Germany, Italy, they all fought major land wars. World War One, before that even some of their imperial wars. But World War One was a period in which they all had to actually start recognizing some rights for workers because they were arming them and telling them to go off and die for their country. And I think that actually meant that sort of earlier on they started having to limit what they did to their own working class in order to convince them to go off and die in crazy inter-imperial wars. Whereas the U.S. really didn't militarize its working class in that way until World War II and Korea and Vietnam, which is why it could continue being so brutal to its own working class for so long. And then the second thing is World War II, the kind of fighting the popular war, I think bound some elements of the working class to the American state along with the Wagner Act. But third is just the McCarthy. I mean, it's not just the kind of violence, but people forget that the real heart and soul of the McCarthy era wasn't sending like lefty filmmakers to jail. It was about purging the Democratic Party, the labor movement, of its, not really Democratic Party as much as the labor movement itself, of the real radicals who really were the major organizing force within the labor movement that kept it militant and ready to strike. I mean, it was the left wing, the CIO, the communists, the anarchists, the socialists who were in there, who were the ones who were pushing to organize the South, you know, in Operation Dixie, who organized the Teamsters in Minnesota. They were all the ones who popped up again in the late 60s, early 70s, who tried to do all that wildcat striking. And once you purged the labor movement of its really radical, of the kind of radical elements, not just at the top and medium, but in the rank and file, the kind of shop floor level, it really weakened the labor movement and left it with just this kind of increasingly conservative, compromised, sort of more bureaucratic labor kind of organizations that really weren't up to the task of continuously kind of organizing, demanding of their members the kind of militancy necessary to maintain independence from the state.
A few months ago, we saw an upsurge in West Virginia and several other states, mostly conservative ones, with right-to-work laws and very weak unions, if any at all, with the teachers. Do you think that this is an early sign of some kind of labor revival, or is this what Wallace Stevens called a blaze of summer straw and winter's nick?
I think the blaze of summer straw and winter's nick was something like the Watsonville canning strike of 1985 or the failed Hormel strike, the few successful but mostly disaster strikes of the 80s, which were the kind of last straw. That was when winter was really in America, as Gil Scott-Heron put it. But I think now the reason I think there's it's some intimation of a future is that there are some things that made the teacher strikes very peculiar and not generalizable. They were public sector. It was a group of it was a group of workers who, it turns out, were actually widely publicly, you know, kind of publicly respected. And so even though these were all illegal strikes, and we saw this happen also in Chicago and Seattle a few years ago, it was too politically unpopular to call out the kind of law and the police on them. You just couldn't crush them. So that made it somewhat unique. On the other hand, what makes them very similar is that you have an increasing destruction of all of the normal legal avenues for addressing labor's concern. I mean, the Janus decision is just like another nail in the coffin of the very weak institutions for incorporating the labor movement into American politics. So there's less and less to get out of the normal avenues and more to get out of extra institutional avenues like the strike. But also what's producing these strikes are very common working class experiences, which is not just declining or stagnating wages, but importantly, rising healthcare costs. I mean, rising healthcare costs have been the main thing prompting, kind of just forcing workers into what they saw were acts of desperation. I mean, the Verizon strike of 2016, it was one of the same issues. They actually went on strike thinking they were going to lose. I remember when I talked to them, they just thought they were going to lose, but they're like, we just can't take this anymore. We've been taking it. We can't do it anymore, and it's too damn expensive. And we just know that if we sit down now, they're going to come back at us again. And that was the same thing with the West Virginia strike, which kind of started off all off, which was this increase in healthcare costs. And if there's an issue, one thing of all that was about Obamacare, one thing I think it did do was create a kind of general expectation among everybody that they should have a right to affordable health care. And as they find themselves facing more and more expensive healthcare costs and healthcare insurance, or health insurance, I think you're going to just see more and more people willing to engage in acts of desperation. That's often what starts strike waves, is some group of workers just won't take it anymore. People realize you can do this, and more people will try it out. And I think we have to be ready for there being a lot of failure and mistakes. But I'm actually a bit hopeful, because I think that the kind of ice is cracking on the thought that you can't do anything with collective action, which was, I think, the heart and soul of the neoliberal period, beginning late 80s, but especially the Clinton era, which was all about individual responsibility and getting ahead on your own and taking out debt to go to get an education and so on. I think it's the lesson that actually collective action can get the goods. And so I'm slightly hopeful that both the kind of subjective experience of people seeing that strikes can win, and just the objective tendency of the economy, is that it's going to just – it's creating desperation that cannot be managed any other way. I don't think it's good that it's creating desperation, but I think it's likely to – for these same reasons, the same reasons that provoked the teachers to go on strike, to provoke many other groups to also kind of try and demand more.
That was Alex Gurevich, an assistant professor of political science at Brown. Let's go out with this, some of the song Alex mentioned in the interview, Gil Scott Heron's Winter in America. Till next week, bye.
Just like the city that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed. Sent away. But the people know it's winter. Winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows.